Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Today on the program are stories from Ann Ball, Jonathan Evans, Marcia James, John Russell, and me. And as always, we end the show with an American story. This week, we hear part three of The Blue Hotel by Stephen Crane. But now, here is Ann Ball.
The White House said this week that President Donald Trump is delaying his decision on the climate treaty for the second time. During the election, Trump said he would withdraw the U.S. from the Paris Agreement on climate change. He has said it is bad for the U.S. economy and hurts the coal industry. Pressure has been building, however, on the U.S. administration to remain a part of the Paris Climate Change Agreement. It was signed by 195 nations, including the U.S., in Paris in 2015. The treaty seeks to reduce global warming by cutting greenhouse gases around the world. China, the United States, and the European Union are the world's worst polluters. If the United States pulls out of the climate change agreement, it would slow the progress towards cutting greenhouse gas emissions. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Federica Mogherini spoke Tuesday at the United Nations in New York City.
Everything is linked. So we continue to expect that the United States will find a way to remain committed to the Paris Agreement. I know there is a debate ongoing, and we respect it very much, but 195 countries have signed the deal on climate change, and there will be 195 different paths to meeting the Paris goals and honoring the agreement. And I am sure there is room for the U.S. administration to find its own path.
Trump has often said that there is no proof of global warming. But on Tuesday, the White House said that the president has again delayed the decision on whether he will follow the Paris Agreement. His top officials have appeared divided over what to do about the deal. Sean Spicer, the White House press secretary, said Trump wants to have more discussions on the issue with his advisors.
The president has been meeting with his team for quite a while on this matter, and he will not be making an announcement regarding that agreement until after he returns from the G7.
The G7 meeting of countries will take place later this month in Italy. Spicer said Trump is seeking advice from both economic and environmental viewpoints as he works to reach a decision. The Paris Accord was signed by former President Barack Obama. He supports environmental protection. At a meeting in Milan, Italy, on Tuesday, Obama said he believes the U.S. will move in the right direction.
The good news is that in part because of what we did over the last 8 years, the private sector has already made a determination that our future is in clean energy. Investments are already moving into clean energy.
Former UN Chief Kofi Annan told the Associated Press that the U.S. would isolate itself if it withdraws from the Paris Agreement. But, he said, the rest of the international community will go ahead, as will American businesses.
Even if U.S. pulls out tomorrow, I will put money on the table that they will go back in 4 years or so. And the business community, the private sector, is committed.
Trump's views on climate change have led to protests. Environmental activists, scientists, and average citizens marched in many cities in the U.S. and around the world last month to protest his positions. A political group called 314 Action helps people with science and math backgrounds run for political office. The group reports that since January, 5,000 people across the U.S. have said they want to run for public office to protect and support science research. I'm Ann Ball.
Former United States President Bill Clinton is joining with American writer James Patterson to write a novel. The book will be called The President is Missing. It is to be released in June 2018. The new work will be an unusual joint project of publishers Alfred A. Knopf and Little, Brown & Company. In a statement this week, the publishers called the book a combination of intrigue, suspense, and behind-the-scenes global drama from the highest corridors of power. It will be informed by details that only a president can know. In the statement, Clinton said, "Working on a book about a sitting president, drawing on what I know about the job, life in the White House, and the way Washington works has been a lot of fun." In a statement, Patterson called working with the former president the highlight of his career. He added, "I'm a storyteller, and President Clinton's insight has allowed us to tell a really interesting one. It's a rare combination. Readers will be drawn to the suspense, of course, but they'll also be given an inside look into what it's like to be president." Patterson has written a large number of best-selling novels with other people, including his son Jack. Former presidents rarely write novels, but Jimmy Carter, who was president from 1977 to 1981, published the historical novel The Hornet's Nest in 2003. And Margaret Truman, the daughter of former President Harry Truman, had a successful career as a writer. She wrote a series of mysteries. Her father served as president from 1945 to 1953. I'm Marcia James.
Albanian-American singer Ermanela Yaho will play the part of Madame Butterfly in the opera of the same name this month in Washington, D.C. Yaho has impressed people throughout Europe with her singing and acting abilities. She is becoming one of the opera world's most popular soprano singers. Yaho says she is successful because she puts a lot of emotion into her work. She says in the Albanian and Balkan traditions, joy and grief are openly displayed. She says she is a citizen of the world, but with an Albanian soul. She says she expresses many emotions when she sings and acts.
I will try to give Ermanela's soul everything as I did it, you know, in the other productions. And I hope my heart, my feelings, the truth that I will give on stage will resonate with the public here.
Yahoo decided to become an opera singer when she saw Giuseppe Verdi's Traviata when she was a teenager. She wanted to play the part of Violetta, and she has made her dream come true. She has performed the role 240 times all over the world. Although opera audiences are loyal, they are mostly older. Few young people like the opera. To get younger people to attend the opera or even become opera singers, One Night of Madame Butterfly will be performed by young artists. Yahoo recognizes this reality and has mixed feelings.
It feels like you belong another period. It feels a little, I feel a little old, if I have to think, you know, in that way. But I think the problem here is that now the life that we are living every day is going so fast with the technology and everything. And I think even, you know, the music, you know, maybe needs that kind of impact immediately. But in classical music, opera, and you need time. You need time to train yourself technically to express.
She says the hard work and the time she dedicates to becoming a good performer help her make good decisions in life. She says her decisions now are not rushed or impulsive. And she says the hard work has not changed the way she feels about opera.
I'm still in love with the opera, and I still feel like a young girl when I started to dream about that.
Part of that dream is to bring new life to the fragility, strength, and tragic end of Madame Butterfly. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus, a famous American circus, will broadcast its final performance on Facebook Live. Earlier this year, Feld Entertainment, the company that owns the famous circus, said that the show would end in May. The plan is to stream the last show on social media and on the circus's website. The final show will be May 21st. In New York. Kristen Michelle Wilson, Ringling's first female ringmaster, will host the event. A circus is a traveling show that is often performed in a tent. These shows include trained animals, clowns, and acrobats. The circus has been a popular form of entertainment in the United States since the mid-1800s. At that time, Phineas Taylor Barnum made a traveling show with animals and human oddities popular. The five Ringling Brothers performed juggling acts and skits in the American state of Wisconsin. Eventually, Barnum's group joined with the Ringling Brothers to form what has been called the first modern circus. The circus's decline had many reasons. They include changing public tastes, high operating costs, and public battles with animal rights groups. Sam Gomez is the circus's vice president of digital and relationship marketing. He says that organizers of the final show believe many people will watch it on phones and tablet computers. It's basically a TV shoot, and we're certainly thinking about lighting and sound, Gomez said. We've had lots of conversations about tight shots so you can see the performer's skill and expressions and their artistry. Gomez said Ringling would leave the video online for a short time, but not forever. The live show allows people to witness the end of an era. Gomez said, "We wanted to give families around the world one last chance to experience the greatest show on Earth together." I'm John Russell.
For more than 3 years, television show host Ellen DeGeneres has held the world record for most retweeted Twitter message. More than 3.4 million people have retweeted a selfie-style photo she took while she was hosting the 2014 Academy Awards show, or Oscars. Hollywood stars like Jennifer Lawrence, Brad Pitt, Angelina Jolie, and Bradley Cooper are in the photo with her. Now, however, the retweet record belongs to someone else. Unlike Ellen, he is not famous. His name is Carter Wilkerson. He is 16 years old and lives in Reno, Nevada. On April 5th, he posted a question on Twitter. "Yo, at Wendy's, how many retweets for a year of chicken nuggets?" he wrote. Wendy's is a fast food restaurant. There are many of them all over the United States. They serve food like hamburgers, French fries, ice cream, and yes, chicken nuggets, small pieces of fried chicken. Wendy's quickly came up with a number for Wilkerson. The company said on Twitter, it would give him free chicken nuggets for a year for 18 million retweets. Later that day, Wilkerson posted a picture of his question and Wendy's answer. He asked Twitter users to help him reach his goal of 18 million retweets. Wilkerson's campaign for free chicken nuggets soon went viral. Famous people like actors, sports stars, and politicians retweeted. So did many lesser-known Twitter users. They used the hashtag #NugsForCarter. Nugs is a short form of nuggets. Earlier this week, Wilkerson reached 3.42 million retweets. That is still well short of Wendy's request for 18 million. But it was enough to break the world record on Twitter. It was also enough, apparently, for Wendy's. The company said it would give Wilkerson free nuggets for a year anyway. Wendy's officials congratulated him for breaking the Twitter record. They also announced a donation of $100,000 to the Dave Thomas Foundation for Adoption. Thomas was the founder of Wendy's Restaurants. He started the aid organization to help find homes for children under the care of the government. Carter Wilkerson himself created a website to help raise money for the foundation. Other Twitter users are now following Wilkerson's lead. One asked President Trump how many retweets he would need to receive a year of college for free.
The Blue Hotel, Part 3.
The men prepared to go out. The Easterner was so nervous that he had great difficulty putting on his new leather coat. As the cowboy pulled his fur cap down over his ears, his hands trembled. In fact, Johnny and Old Scully were the only ones who displayed no emotion. No words were spoken during these proceedings. Scully threw open the door. Instantly, a wild wind caused the flame of the lamp to struggle for its life. The men lowered their heads and pushed out into the cold. No snow was falling, but great clouds of it, swept up from the ground by the fierce winds, were streaming all around. The covered land was a deep blue, and there was no other color except one light shining from the low black railroad station. It looked like a tiny jewel. The men turned their backs upon the wind and walked to the shelter side of the hotel. Here, a V-shaped piece of icy grass had not been covered by the snow. When they reached the spot, it was heard that the Swede was still screaming.
Oh, I know what kind of a thing this is. I know you'll jump on me. I can't beat you all.
Scully turned on him angrily.
You won't have to beat all of us. You'll have to beat my son, Johnny. And the man that troubles you during that time will have to deal with me.
The arrangements were quickly made. The two men faced each other, obeying the short commands of Scully. The Easterner was already cold, and he was jumping up and down. The cowboys stood rock-like. The fighters had not removed any clothing. Their hands were ready, and they eyed each other in a calm way that had the elements of fierce cruelty in it.
Now,
said Scully. The two leaped forward and struck together like oxen. There was heard the dull sound of blows and of a curse pressed out between the tight teeth of one. As for the watchers, the Easterners held in breath burst from him in relief, pure relief after the anxious waiting. The cowboy leaped into the air with a scream. Scully stood unmoving, as if in complete surprise and fear at the fierceness of the fight which he himself had permitted and arranged. For a time, the fight in the darkness was such a scene of flying arms that it showed no more detail than a moving wheel. Sometimes a face would shine out, frightful and marked with pink spots. A moment later, the men would be only shadows. Suddenly, the cowboy was caught by warlike desires, and he leaped forward with the speed of a wild horse.
Hit him, Johnny! Hit him! Kill him! Kill him!
Keep still,
said Scully icily. Then there was a sudden loud sound, dull, incomplete, cut short. Johnny's body fell away from the Swede with sickening heaviness to the grass. The cowboy hardly had time to prevent the mad Swede from throwing himself upon the fallen body. Scully was at his son's side.
Johnny, Johnny, my boy.
His voice had a quality of sad tenderness.
Johnny, can you fight some more?
He looked anxiously down into the bloody, beaten face of his son. There was a moment of silence. And then Johnny answered in his ordinary voice.
Yes, I... It...
Yes.
Helped by his father, he struggled to his feet.
Wait a minute now till you get your breath,
said the old man. A few steps away, the cowboy was telling the Swede.
No, you don't. Wait a second.
The Easterner was pulling at Scully's arm.
Oh, this is enough,
he begged.
This is enough. Let it go as it is. This is enough.
Bill,
said Scully.
Get out of the way.
The cowboy stepped aside.
Now.
The fighters advanced toward each other. Then the Swede aimed a lightning blow that carried with it his entire weight. Johnny, though faint from weakness, luckily stepped aside, and the unbalanced Swede fell to the ground. The cowboy, Scully, and the Easterner cheered. But before its finish, the Swede was up and attacking his enemy madly. There were more wildly moving arms, and Johnny's body again fell away like a stone. The Swede quickly struggled to a little tree and leaned upon it, breathing hard while his fierce and flame-lit eyes wandered from face to face as the men bent over Johnny.
Can you still fight, Johnny?
Asked Scully in a voice of despair. After a moment, the son answered.
No, I can't fight anymore.
Then, from shame and bodily ill, he began to weep, the tears pouring down through the blood on his face.
He was too heavy for me.
Scully straightened and spoke to the waiting figure.
Stranger,
he said calmly,
we're finished.
Then his voice changed into that deep and quiet tone, which is the tone of the most simple and deadly announcements.
Johnny is beaten.
Without replying, the winner moved away to the door of the hotel. The others raised Johnny from the ground, and as soon as he was on his feet, he refused all attempts at help. When the group came around the corner, they were almost blinded by the blowing snow. It burned their faces like fire. The cowboy carried Johnny through the piles of snow to the door. Inside, they were greeted by a warm stove and women who took Johnny to the kitchen. The three others sat around the heat, and the sad quiet was broken only by the sounds overhead when the Swede moved about in his room. Soon they heard him on the stairs. He threw the door open and walked straight to the middle of the room. No one looked at him.
Well,
he said loudly to Scully,
I suppose you'll tell me now how much I owe you.
The old man, with a dull expression, remained calm.
You don't owe me anything.
Mr. Scully,
called the Swede again,
how much do I owe you?
He was dressed to go, and he had his bag in his hand.
You don't owe me anything,
repeated Scully in the same unmoved way.
I guess you're right. I guess the truth would be that you would owe me something. That's what I guess.
He turned to the cowboy.
Kill him! Kill him! Kill him!
He repeated in the tone the cowboy had used. Then he laughed. But he might have been laughing at the dead. The three men did not move or speak, just stared with glassy eyes at the stove. The Swede opened the door and passed into the storm, giving one last glance at the still group.
That's all the time we have today. I'm Katie Weaver for VOA Learning English. Thanks for listening.